Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Swell.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, is Netflix in trouble? Now, that's the consensus following news last week that the world's largest streaming company shed subscribers for the first time in a decade, maybe longer, coming in well under Wall Street's modest expectations that the service would grow by 2.5 million users in the latest quarter. There are some minor caveats here. You know, if Netflix hadn't lost 700,000 subscribers in Russia, it would have gained 500,000 overall. But that's still well below expectations. More worryingly for Netflix is the decline in user numbers in North America. They lost 600,000 subs in the United States and Canada over the first 3 months of this year. Netflix's stock plummeted again, and the company now has about a third of the market capitalization it did at the beginning of this year. Bad year so far for Netflix shareholders. Rough stretch for the service that still has 200 million some subscribers worldwide, or more than, the next two or maybe even three services put together. The big question here is less what happens to Netflix and more how it reorients Hollywood's understanding of the current business moment. For instance, Matt Bellany reports in his newsletter that Batgirl, which is a $70 million movie that's done, is previously destined for exclusivity on HBO Max, may get a theatrical run before headed to the streamer. Now, the reason for that doesn't have to do with Netflix's stock price so much as the success of The Batman, which grossed $750 million before heading to HBO Max, where it is reportedly still putting up huge, huge numbers. Meanwhile, family-friendly fare continues to do well at the box office. Sonic 2 has grossed nearly $150 million domestic. The Bad Guys hit the top range of expectations this weekend to win the box office. And Sing 2 put up a multiple of 8. Now, a multiple, that number refers to the what the movie's final gross was in comparison to its opening weekend. So it opened to a little over $20 million, and it grossed about $160 million for a multiple of 8. That number typically, on average, that number is going to be about 2.7. So it did much, much better in the long run than it did than anybody normally would have expected it to, right? And that movie kept racking up box office even when it was available on VOD. You know, we put all this together with new polling from The Quorum, which shows that moviegoers are sure enough headed back to the theaters, and things are changing a bit. I mean, casual moviegoers increased from 18 to 31% in the latest tracking poll by The Quorum, while hopefuls, that is, people who wanted to return to theaters but have yet to do so, declined from 33% to 18%. Now, it's hard to say whether that decline is entirely because of people going back to theaters or some folks just giving up entirely, but the point is, people are going back. Peter, there's a lot to think about here, but let me offer up a minor provocation. Netflix is in trouble because it is simply the least necessary streaming service, the one with no intellectual property worth owning, the one that has a business model that most encourages people to sign up for a month and then drop it, and the one that is, despite all of this, the most expensive to purchase. Is it just the worst streaming option out there?
I don't know if I would say it's the actual worst streaming option, but I do think that it's remarkable that given how much Netflix has spent on content, and in particular content from top-tier creators in Hollywood, that they have not managed to produce an IP that has taken on a life of its own. Probably the closest thing that they have is Stranger Things. Stranger Things is going to end, I believe, this year with its final season. And it's not obvious that Stranger Things is going to live on in the popular culture imagination after that. And what HBO and Disney in particular have is IP that was around long before, you know, the streaming revolution, but also that just generates a huge amount of interest whenever you release something. So that's Batman and the whole, you know, DC Comics universe, you know, for HBO. That's Harry Potter, which, despite the failure of the Fantastic Beasts movies, I think people are still going to be reading Harry Potter and watching Harry Potter and thinking about Harry Potter in 10 years. And I don't think that's true with Stranger Things. I don't think that's true with Ozark as much as I like that show. You know, House of Cards, I think I'm a David Fincher fan and I liked the way that that show launched, but it sort of withered and died. It doesn't, nobody talks about House of Cards anymore, right? And it's not that Netflix has no good shows, and it's not that they've never produced anything of quality. I think Roma is one of the better movies of the last 10 or 15 years, just period. I would probably certainly put it in my top 10 films of the last decade. I thought the Irishman was a great, great movie. And yet, they've never quite cracked the code of being a big part of the cultural conversation and of being delivering products that exist beyond that sort of opening week and weekend of binge watching. And Alyssa has made this argument at length that it's in part because of their binge watching strategy. I also think that it is partly because they actually had a too much money problem. And if you go back to a couple of years before the pandemic, when they were just like increasing spend in ways that looked really crazy, and yet it kept paying off in terms of subscriber growth at that point. There was a story, I believe, in New York Magazine, in which it was revealed that Ted Sarandos, who was then just head of content, he wasn't co-CEO, had made it possible for, I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong on this, listeners, you know, correct me, but my recollection is the story was that Ted Sarandos had created a system in which deputies two levels below him, so not just direct reports, but his direct reports, could overrule him to greenlight a series. That is crazy. When you're talking about spending $30 or $40 or $50 million for a season of television, because they don't do pilots, they just buy a whole season at a time. And so, when you have to create a brand new system where the top guy can't overrule people two levels below him to spend gigantic amounts of money, because if you had the Ted Sarandos has to say yes to everything system in place, you wouldn't spend money fast enough. Then that, it sounds like a good problem to have, but it's actually a creative issue. I think it stifles creativity because you just got to work so fast and push so much stuff through the system that you don't actually get to do quality control.
Yeah, well, you have a too many people saying yes problem. There's just a you need too many people saying yes, not enough people saying no. Alyssa, do you want to take a victory lap here? Because I do think a big problem that is under-discussed in the world of Netflix and its problems is its release model, which when they debuted and when they started putting out House of Cards or Orange is the New Black was seen as a big innovation, big disruption. We're going to do a whole season at a time and people can watch at their own pace and we're competing against sleep. People don't go to sleep. They just watch Orange is the New Black all night. And that just kills the ability to have a conversation that lasts more than 72 hours, right?
Yes, I have written about this at length, and last year I actually took a look at Google Analytics trends for big Netflix shows versus big shows that had come out on cable, and it was just incredibly obvious over and over again. When you had the Netflix shows would peak incredibly quickly, it's like looking at the Himalayas, right? They shoot up, they shoot back down, and then just go away in search trends for a long time. They are only relevant for the sort of immediate aftermath of their release. There is no sustained cultural conversation about them whatsoever. Something like Game of Thrones or, you know, even Billions or Succession, the interest goes up when the episode airs, it plateaus, and then it goes back down again until the next week when it goes back up again. And, you know, to a certain extent, Netflix has a quality control problem. They have made a lot of mediocre television. They have shelled out just enormous sums of money to people like Ryan Murphy who have not made anything, you know, viably interesting for the service because they actually benefit from editing. But they killed any chance of having a sustained cultural conversation about any of their products, not just because people binge them, but because everyone is watching on their own schedule. And that means, especially in a spoiler-averse culture, you cannot write sustained cultural criticism about the shows as they come out. You can't have a conversation with other people because you have no idea where anyone else is on their watch schedule. You've cut out the thing that made television culturally dominant, right? I mean, it's a huge own goal. And I mean, I think it has implications beyond Netflix business model, although it's obviously, I think, turned out to be bad for Netflix's business model. But it makes us, you know, it takes this thing that was a source of tremendous communal pleasure and makes it atomized and lonely. And it's, I think, both economically destructive for the service and also sort of culturally and emotionally destructive to something that was once a great unifier.
So, Alyssa, I just want to sort of jump in here and say, like, we talk about this as cultural critics. It's like frustrating for us because it makes writing about these shows difficult, even when they are good or interesting in some ways. And obviously that's what's of interest to us. But I think the thing that is really clear this week is what you touched on just a little bit, which is this is bad for business, because television in particular, and shows sometimes start out with a bang, but especially these days, shows that get big grow over time because of word of mouth. And what Netflix did by dumping shows all at once, you know, once every 12 to 18 months, you know, you get a new season and that's that, is they cut off the word of mouth. And so without word of mouth, you don't have a show, for example, like Breaking Bad. Now, Breaking Bad also was a product of Netflix because the word of mouth meant that people went back and watched it on Netflix. And yet, Breaking Bad was continued to be released on a one episode per week model on regular television. And so what they did was they destroyed their native advertising, right? Like their kind of their organic advertising. In hopes of just sort of capturing, like, the I forgot to cancel my service dollars. And they captured a lot of them. It's also, like, really weird that we're talking about Netflix is like, sort of in a disaster position when it is a company with 220 million paying subscribers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it has a huge first mover advantage is the thing, right? It has an enormous advantage because they were the first. Everybody likes them. They're still, I hear from folks who have, like, a nostalgia response to Netflix. They're like, "Oh, I've had Netflix for 10 years now. I can't cancel Netflix. That's my lodestar. It's what guides me."
I remember getting my DVD envelopes in the mail.
Exactly.
I just canceled my DVD plan last week. When I read this news, I went back and I looked at what I was paying for Netflix and what plan I was on. And realized that I still had a DVD plan. I don't think I've gotten a DVD in 10 years.
See, that's how they get you. You are the AOL model there. The old people who still have AOL.
I think I looked at this like 3 years ago and was like, well, in theory, I might need to get access to a movie for like research purposes. And this might come in handy somehow or another because the DVD library is really quite large, or was even just a couple of years ago. But
Peter, if I can jump back in just to expand on a couple of things you said. I mean, the binge model is a business problem for two particularly salient reasons. First, it forces Netflix to up its content spend, because if you're going to watch everything in a weekend as opposed to 8 to 12 or even 20 weeks, you need to have something new to offer people all of the time. And Netflix has spent a fantastical amount of money on content. But also, it increases your possibility for churn, because if you're someone like me, for example, who basically only watches like Bridgerton or Inventing Anna on Netflix right now, which to me suggests that I should just have like a Shondaland subscription somewhere, you can watch Bridgerton or Inventing Anna in a weekend and then cancel your subscription for the next 12 months or 10 months or, you know, for however long you need it. And, you know, Sunny, you're right that Netflix has a first mover advantage, but it also means that they were sort of the first company to kind of figure out where the ceiling was on this business, right? And, you know, if people are going to start sorting between their streaming subscriptions and toggling back and forth because it's not worth it to them to subscribe to Netflix for 12 months because reassembling the bundle is actually really expensive, you need to decrease churn, right? You need to be essential all of the time. And the binge model forces you to spend a lot more money to be that.
I also think that they had an issue where they thought they were going to be cable and that they were going to replace cable. And
they thought they were going to be TV just in general.
But they were cable TV. And so the whole thing about cable was creating a competitor to cable in 1995 was quite difficult because you had to physically lay lay like wiring to get to everyone's house. Now, yes, there was some satellite in the 1990s, but for the most part, you had like it was actual cable, and it literally required not just the expense of doing that, which was incredible, but also all of the sort of political, like the permitting process. And so, as it turned out, it's pretty easy. It's not that easy. But it's pretty easy to start a competitor to Netflix. All you need is a lot of money and some experience making shows. And Disney and Warner Brothers had that already. And so, yes, obviously, like, those are huge expenditures. And you and I, none of us on this podcast could just start a streaming service to rival Netflix. But another media company could. And they didn't have to go through, you know, the permitting process and the like the physical labor of laying cables to every person's house in the way that kept that where cable sort of ended up being this sort of quasi monopoly for a long period of time. And look, we all still have our, you know, many of us still have cable internet packages and subscriptions because of this. And so I think they're thinking that they were going to be cable TV underestimated the ease with which another large organization could set up a competitor, and several have, and those competitors have turned out to be pretty good and pretty useful.
I want to push back on that a little bit, though, because Netflix has never tried to compete in two of the key arenas for cable, which are sports. They don't pursue, you know, the rights to anything, and they don't do news. And those are crucial components of the bundle that Netflix just never tried to play in.
That's totally fair. I think that's totally fair. And they weren't trying to be, I should maybe, you know, I will back off. They weren't trying to exactly be cable, but they were trying to be the next thing that's like sort of tax-like for television delivery to your house, right? Like by the 1990s, the vast majority of American homes didn't get their TV from the airwaves. They got it from a cable subscription of some sort, whether it was a basic package or a more expanded one. And it wasn't, you know, it's not literally a tax, obviously. You could choose not to have it, but virtually no homes chose not to have it. I mean, not quite virtually no, but it was something like 90% of America had cable with ESPN and, you know, the rest of it, right? And Netflix assumed that they would be in that position and that that by sort of getting there first, they would make it quite difficult for competitors to pop up.
Yeah, I think that's mostly true. Yeah. And I think that the reason that Netflix could afford to make so much content, because remember, this is not a company with like a long history of turning a profit. They are accumulating debt. They are burning through, you know, investor cash. They're in more trouble than people give them credit for, if that's the right way to put that. But I think there is bad times on the horizon for Netflix. And what they need to do is be more like HBO Max, have some higher quality programming that people need to see, or Apple TV Plus, or even Hulu does a better job, frankly, than Netflix in terms of their originals. All right, so what do we think here? Hold on, let me pull up the exit question. Exit question. So what do we think? Is Netflix doomed? Peter?
It's not doomed. They have 220 million subscribers, and there's a viable business to be made out of a product with even half that subscription number. But their current model is not sustainable. And people have been saying this for several years now, and we have the first clear evidence that that's the case.
Alyssa?
I don't think Netflix is doomed, but I think that the binge model probably should be if they want to survive.
Netflix is doomed. Like all things, they will return to dust. And you know, the long enough timeline, what is it? On a long enough timeline, the survival horizon is zero? Is that what the...
But the real question is, will Netflix enter Valhalla?
Yeah, well, speaking of which, we'll get to that in one sec. On this Friday's bonus episode at atma.thebulwark.com, we're going to talk about our favorite historical epics. Swords, sandals, war, love, death, life, in the past. That's what we're talking about. Speaking of which, on to the main event. The Northmen, directed by Robert Eggers, who has made a career out of looking at period settings and loving detail with the use of authentic language and location. Movies like The Witch, right, which was set in 16th century England, New England, and The Lighthouse, which was set in 19th century New England. He has left New England. He's taken his talents to Iceland and the Nordic wastes around the turn of the 10th century. If you want to understand the Northmen, here's how I would pitch it to you. Think Hamlet as reimagined by the fictional heavy metal band Death Clock from the Adult Swim series Metalocalypse. You got some idea of what you're in for here. Alexander Skarsgård stars as Amleth, a prince whose father, played by Ethan Hawke, is murdered in front of him by his uncle Fjolnir. Fjolnir captures Amleth's mother, played by Nicole Kidman, and takes her away from the village. She's screaming the whole way, and Amleth, he rows away into the frozen, icy wastes of the, I don't know, the North Atlantic, I guess. He's plotting revenge, and we cut to decades later, and he is all grown into a savage warrior who, upon hearing of Fjolnir's whereabouts, places himself into slavery to get under Fjolnir's thumb in order to wreak his bloody vengeance, and much bloody vengeance is wreaked, along with insane visions of the North gods and various witches and wizards. Like, I have a lot of issues with the Northmen. My written review was mixed positive, I think is fair to say. And it has problems. It is altogether too long at 135 or so minutes. It's unevenly paced, and it's weirdly slow at times for a movie that, among other things, features a deadly game of field hockey, a bloody sacking of a Nordic city that culminates in a house full of children and the elderly being burned to death while warriors laugh and cheer and drink mead, and a guy talking to Willem Dafoe's skull. The whole middle hour drags despite all of this. And Alexander Skarsgård, as much as I liked him on True Blood, and I did like him on True Blood, I think he's very good, is just not that great of a presence here. He doesn't have the big screen it, whatever the big screen it is. He's fine on TV. We were discussing before, he was very good on the show with Nicole Kidman that he starred in. Big Little Lies. But not so good here. I don't know if it's just the big screen or what. He doesn't have it. And as much as I like the guy, he just wilts in comparison to, like, Anya Taylor-Joy, who is lovely in this. She is just a delightful and entrancing presence on the big screen. And I've been a fan ever since The Witch. I mean, she is just interesting to look at. And yet, The Northman, when it does work, is fairly entrancing. And it is also refreshingly unmodern. And what I mean is it's completely unmoored from modern notions of sentiment. It's completely ignorant of modern notions of justice, right? It's so ignorant that one couldn't even really say this film exists as a rejection of modernity. It just doesn't recognize it. It's a totally alien. It's as alien to this movie as this movie's ethos is alien to us. It's set 1,000 years ago. Of course it's going to be alien. Its ancient quality is its power. And while you're watching it, you can believe in witches and visions of Valkyries and all sorts of crazy random things taking place in this land so far removed from our own. But this journey may be fundamentally silly to some. Alyssa, what did you make of The Northman?
Guys, I thought this was goofy. And I say this as someone who, like, I find authenticity as a concept sort of interesting for movies and television in the sense that they can create a sort of more detailed world. They can make things just feel different from each other, right? But if the purpose of extreme authenticity in this movie, and that's kind of been the selling point, like Alexander Skarsgård wore one pair of shoes through the entire shoot of The Northman and I cobbler repaired them, this kind of thing. If the purpose of authenticity in this movie is supposed to be to transport you out of time and place to someplace totally alien, that just did not happen for me. And I almost wonder if it's because it, you know, if your goal is to get viewers into a radically different mindset, I'm actually not sure it works to shoot a movie this sort of realistically with the bits of, you know, like Bjork in a, you know, shell and feather headdress thrown in. It just did not work for me to an extent that all of the talk about authenticity made me feel like the movie was more pretentious than I think it wants to be. And I agree with you about Skarsgård, who I think just does not work in this movie. Like, he's very big. The moment when he, like, catches a spear that's thrown at him and turns it around and throws it back is pretty cool. But he doesn't become really sort of animated or intriguing, except in the one scene where Nicole Kidman, who plays his mother, kind of upends the story of his whole life and is like, I was not a victim in this. Like, I was not, you know, carried off by my brother-in-law. I wanted my brother-in-law to kill my husband because he was horrible to me and I was enslaved to him. And it's the worst. And you know what? I actually really like being an Icelandic sheep herder's wife. Thank you very much. Like, go impale yourself on a battle axe. And, you know, that moment when he's playing just this, like, sort of total inability to take in that information is the most interesting one in the movie, at least in terms of his performance. But the rest of the time, he looks like he got hit upside the head in one of those field hockey games and has never fully recovered his senses. I found it very silly and overwrought. And I am open to, even very interested in, being completely transported to a different mindset. But I don't think this movie achieves that at all. And I don't think the sort of obsessive attention to detail ends up contributing to it.
Well, it reminds me a bit of The Witch, in that The Witch takes the story of a witch hunt and essentially says, no, but what if witches were real? Which is a very confusing thing for modern audiences who have been trained to see, you know, oh, a witch hunt, that means somebody's being oppressed. Somebody is being hunted for their beliefs, or, you know, taken, right, to, you know, abused because of their sex or whatever. And we have to figure out what the actual power structure is that is making all of this happen. But the witch says, no, witches are real. And here's why they might be appealing to somebody who is totally alienated from their family. And this movie basically says, like, okay, what if, like, Norse legends were real? And what if, like, what if, you know, people saw Valkyries? What if people saw visions of witches? What if they talked to Willem Dafoe's skull, like Yorick?
But right? This movie does not, you know, give you the sense of what it is like to sort of live day to day with that belief that, you know, the world is animate and the gods are close. I mean, you insert these moments of strangeness periodically, but I think the choice to film realistically kind of ends up undercutting that goal of making you see the world radically differently. Because if the goal is to get you into a very different mindset, shooting much of this like a sort of conventional period epic, but then adding in murderous field hockey, doesn't actually make you see the world through different eyes. I think one of the best comparisons for this, to sort of explain what I am trying to express, I think not very well. Have both of you read Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall?
No.
Okay. First in a fantastic three-part series about Thomas Cromwell. And Thomas Cromwell is an interesting character because he represents the sort of emergence of modern man in England. But the novel is sort of imbued with this language that helps you understand what it is like to live among people who believe that spirits are real, who, you know, who are totally convinced that the mortification of the flesh contributes to their holiness, that, you know, what it is like to be governed by a king who believes himself sort of victim of witchcraft and deception and magic and the sort of, you know, randomness and terror that that injects into life. And Mantel uses incredibly vivid figurative language to, you know, surround this practical person with wondrous images in a way that, you know, you can relate to Thomas Cromwell because he is modern in a way that many of the characters in the story are not. But you also just see fantastical things coming off you at the page all the time. And when you emphasize the realistic and the prosaic, that makes the world of the Vikings more materially present, but it does not necessarily make their mindset more spiritually present. If what you are saying is that they saw the world in a radically different way than we do, then you actually have to show us a radically different world on screen to get us into that mindset. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying, but I feel like, well, Peter, let's come to you for a second, because I feel like this is a movie where Ethan Hawke and Mr. Skarsgård go underground and start barking like wolves at each other while drinking hallucinogenic mead, which is pretty different. It's a pretty radically different sort of existence.
Let me put it this way.
Am I wrong?
It shows you that they do it, but it doesn't make you feel why they do it or what it means to them. At least that was my experience with it.
Okay, that's fine. Peter, what did you make of The Northman?
I loved it. And I'll just talk about that, how could you not like heavy metal weird Conan, right?
Conan the Barbarian.
What I love, right? That speaks my language. That scene in which they go and bark like dogs, I in some ways agree with you, Alyssa, that it is not a scene that helps you feel like they feel. But that, to me, is one of this movie's strengths. The characters are unrelatable. The movie makes no attempt to make these people relatable to modern audiences. It doesn't attempt to give them any kind of modern values or even think about modern values or morality in any way. It doesn't give them modern motivations. It doesn't in any way want them to feel like the kind of people you know or hang out with or are yourself, right? And this is just like breaks every rule of screenwriting, where heroes are supposed to be relatable and even more than that, rootable, right? Like is a word that screenwriters throw out, is rootability, right? Is that movie makers who want to make popular commercial films want audiences to be invested in the main character's journey and in their goals. This movie is just like, I don't care if you're invested at all. This is happening, and it's going to look interesting, and that's what's and like we're not going to explain it to you. And part of the movie's ethos is, relates to this is that it doesn't deliver any exposition. There's no scene in which any character is like, well, so you, let me just like tell you what the we Viking warriors think of ourselves as basically like we see no difference between ourselves. It's us and dogs and wolves, and we're all kind of the same. So we're going to do this ritual, and it's in a way in which, right? No, that doesn't happen. It's just like we're wolves and we're wearing wolf hats and skins and like doing killing people. We don't care. We want to die. We want to die glory. Like, that's it. It's just. You see them behaving as like in their way, not in our way. And I can fall for a movie that has a great relatable protagonist, even a historical one that's, you know, somewhat, that's not quite perfectly accurate. I am open to that. I like to root for a protagonist. I'm not like against that. At the same time, I'm always a little bothered by the fact that, like, this is a standard in Hollywood, that this is what they expect everybody to do. And, of course, the reason is because this is what a lot of people, viewers, very clearly want. And films test badly when audiences feel like they can't relate to their protagonists and aren't invested in that journey. But this movie just doesn't in any way care about that. It is in some ways designed to leave you a little bit cold, a little bit distant, a little bit uncaring about what happens going on. And I think so that, you know, leads me to my final point, which is I think that's why part of why Alexander Skarsgård's performance works, because the performance isn't designed to bring you in the way of like a classic big screen movie star performance. It's just supposed to be he's like a giant dude who's angry. And he does some stuff because he's angry. And he's got like a simple, strange worldview that's just there. That's not one that's particularly relatable, right? That's not one that's like it's like, oh, you can like, sure, right? They killed his dad. Like, that's fine. It's movie villain stuff. But it's just weirder and stranger and more disconnected than that. And this movie is just absolutely willing to like not appeal to the base impulses, like the desire for for conventionality and for relatability in audiences. And I respect the hell out of that, because I will say, like, when I wrote fiction in college, the most consistent criticism was that my characters were unrelatable. And so, like, I've always been like, what is it that people... I've learned more about how this works, but, like, I don't care that much.
I think we're unlocking the key to the Peter Suderman experience here right now. We're turning a key and the tumblers are falling into place, frankly.
Can I push back against, like,
sure,
a bunch of that?
Fight me!
I will meet you at the gates of hell. First, I want to push back on the idea that this movie looks great, because I'm sorry, like, the climactic thing is, like, two naked guys fighting each other in, like, a badly lit volcano fight, and, like, one of them standing there with his head cut off and the other one impaled. It looks ridiculous. Like, that stuff is...
ridiculously awesome?
That scene looked dumb.
Ridiculously great?
No,
I don't...
The worst.
You're missing words here.
But I think your premise about sort of what I'm talking about in terms of relatability and sort of getting into a different mindset, there's like a fundamental mistake you're making here, which is that a protagonist and
wouldn't
a story don't have to be relatable in order to be fascinating or transporting. And I come back to that verb a lot, even though it's like kind of a bullshit verb, because what fundamentally great art that endures over centuries or even millennia does is brings you to a different mindset, right? I mean, the Iliad and the Odyssey, I mean, the Iliad in particular, does not have characters that, like, in a modern way we would understand as relatable, right? I mean, that is a conflict over values of honor that, you know, do not translate to the present at all. And it involves a value system where people believe the gods are actively intervening in their lives, often in capricious ways. And yet, the Iliad is still tremendously readable. It's repeatedly translated because it is not relatable in modern terms. It is transporting. It brings you into a place and a set of circumstances and a group of characters who are unlike you, who see the world in a way that is not accessible to us, and yet make you live there for a while. I don't know if either of you have read The Secret History, which is Donna Tartt's first novel, and it's about a group of kids in a New England college who are basically trying to recreate, like, a mystic Greek ritual and summon the god Dionysus and succeed in doing it as they understand it. And, you know, one of the characters talks
and
about...
And there are consequences.
There are so many consequences. But one of the characters talks about sort of the difficulty of losing your mind and then putting it back together. And that's actually what great art does to you for the period when you're reading it. Great art that's set in a different culture and ethos and mindset. It takes you somewhere else, and then you come back to yourself having learned something new. I mean, you know, there is a reason that certain kinds of art endures. And I think there is a difference between, like, saying that, like, we have to be able to root for Alexander Skarsgård's character and saying, like, I would have liked to occupy his mindset more fully than I think I do in the movie. And I think that the specific choices about sort of hyper-realism and authenticity do not serve that end. Does that make any sense as sort of a distinction? I don't think what I'm calling for here is relatability or rootability. In fact, Alison Wilmore had a good piece about this in Vulture about how that scene between Skarsgård and Kidman is one of the most interesting in the movie, because the movie very deliberately does not choose to sort of make Kidman's character a misunderstood hero. It still sort of preserves her as a monstrous person for having precipitated this murder that upends, you know, Amleth's entire world and life. So I'm not talking about the need for relatability, but I did want something. I wanted it to be weirder, honestly. I think it would have made it more effective.
I take your point about the Iliad. I thought the verisimilitude of the settings and of the clothing was great. And it looks different than other period films in a way that I thought really, like, you could see it on screen, right? They're using highly realistic replica Viking boats. The costume designer is just absolutely obsessed with getting every little detail right. The sets are built to be as realistic as we possibly can, could, you know, make them today. And it just doesn't look like anything I can think of ever having seen on screen before. And so to me, that aspect of it was pretty effective. But I take your point about, I don't know if I think this is great art in the sense of like, it's going to be something that, you know, people are still watching in 50 years, much less reading and engaging with in thousands like the Iliad. But I do think that there is something pretty powerful about this film, and also pretty striking just about the way that it is not willing to sort of meet audiences where they are, and instead to just do its own truly weird thing and to be difficult and cold and distant.
I will say, just as a parting idea here, that I think the movie would have been helped by being condensed by about 25 to 30 minutes. If you had the things that were very strange kind of piling up one on top of each other in quicker succession, I think it would have gotten to part of the problem that Alyssa is describing here. Because again, I feel like once he gets on the slaver's ship to go to Iceland, things hit a bit of a wall. It just like there's just a whole bunch of stuff that happens and is essentially setting up plot stuff that doesn't matter. Like the movie comes to kind of a grinding halt, which is bad. It should have been more mound demon fights and volcano fights and deadly field hockey and assaults on villages and burning of children and the elderly. Like that should have, the whole thing should have been that, just a series of ultra violent images one after the other, a Clockwork Orange style, everyone strapped to their chairs.
Now I feel like we're getting deep into the Sunny psychology here. Like if you want to talk about like the key to Sunny is like, cut out all the Borg parts where they do stuff that isn't murder and just have the murder parts.
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to solve Alyssa's problem here.
And the key to the Alyssa worldview is like, actually we should be reading books.
Yeah, you talked a lot about reading books on this episode, which
Sorry.
I don't appreciate.
Sorry.
This is a show about watching things, not reading things. How dare you? All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Northman? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Thumbs up. Quite liked it.
Thumbs up. Mixed positive, but, you know, again, a guy gets headbutted to death after a game of field hockey in which the opponent was about to take a stick to a child's skull. So, I mean, like, that's a thumbs up right there just on its own. That is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on our favorite historical epics. And make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.